Advertising and marketing, like people, are constantly changing. But there are things that remain exactly the same. Alistair King, the co-founder of King James, which was acquired by Accenture, takes us through some of these changes.
It's the little thing that you add to it that's going to break the predictability chain of the program, is that's going to make it exceptional and make it different. And that's going to always be the game of creativity, no matter what category you're in.
We talk about how to build on an idea that resonates with communities. We get into why now is probably one of the best times to build an independent creative agency. To help us grow and bring more inspiring guests, please subscribe to The Lead Creative wherever you are listening. And while you're there, leave us a rating and a review. It makes a world of difference. Thanks for listening. Enjoy the episode. Welcome to the Lead Creative Podcast, where we talk to creative industry leaders, influencers, and brands. We discuss the strategies that influence brand thinking and shape industries. Thought leaders and heads of agencies let us in on some of their thinking and insights. I'm your host, Mongezi Mthathi. Enjoy the show, and please share and subscribe. Alistair, what an honor to have you on The Lead Creative. I've been following the work for the longest time, and I guess what is to me one of your latest works, which I want to get into, the Philips Hound Wirecar Grand Prix. Thanks so much for making the time.
Thank you, Mongezi. It's really good to be here.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I look forward to the chat. When the King James Accenture deal was fully concluded and you said, right, this is the last thing, I'm closing the laptop or whatever it is that you did, what's the first thing that you did afterwards?
Well, I cried first. It was a very emotional decision, and you kind of cry for it. It doesn't happen quickly, by the way. It takes years to conclude an acquisition. It really does. And it's two very emotional years where you kind of, your emotions are torn. You know, King James was 24 years old, at the time that we decided to sell. So obviously the level of attachment to the company was quite, intense. So, you know, but I was happy. I mean, I went into the acquisition with my eyes wide open, excited about what we could achieve together, but brutally aware that things were going to change for me forever, you know, and that King James was no longer mine, and that takes some getting used to, that idea. And but I immediately set about doing what I said I would do, which is to try to bring together two organizations which were very different to each other. And I was busy learning what they were about, and they were busy learning what we were about. And so that required a lot of my attention, and as well as James's. But, you know, as time went by, you know, I realized I had to be honest with the fact that I had chosen to sell the company, and that I was moving on mentally and emotionally in my brain, and that there was life after King James and certainly life after Accenture. So I suppose what I did was I tried to bury myself in the thing that makes me happy, which is the work. I'm not a good organizational person. I don't function well I don't function in corporates anymore, but I was always happiest sitting behind my desk, thinking, writing ads, coming up with ideas, solving business problems. And that's where I retreated for a good part of those few years. And out of that was born the Philipstown Wirecar project, which was literally the last idea conceptualized under the banner of King James, literally in the last 2 weeks of the company, and took almost 3.5 years to bring into fruition. So, I do thank that project in particular, because it gave me something to dig my teeth into and to bury my creative mind into, and I was very happy to do that. And so I was there from conception to completion, and I continue my life afterwards, remaining with the foundation and continuing what we started, which is to take this wonderful idea to the world and bring some good to the community of Phillipstown in the process.
Yeah. Mm. To outsiders looking in to, you know, at an acquisition deal, it's very inspiring. It's a thing that we all celebrate, and it's definitely worth celebrating, right? What are some of the things, or what's the one thing that you thought going in and you realize coming out of that is either overestimated or undervalued about these kinds of things?
You know, I think some people start companies, whatever industry you're in, they start them with the intention of selling them at some point, you know, when the money's right, for example. We never had that goal ever. We just started a company because we wanted to do our own thing and be masters of our own destiny, so to speak. So, and we had been tempted by offers from virtually all the companies, all the corporates. But, you know, the timing was never right for us. We were loving King James and what we were doing. And so we never anticipated that we would get to that point in time where we would sell. Having said that, the timing was right for us. You know, we were at that point in our lives where we individually and as a company felt like there needed to be something different for the company and something different for James and I and our, and so the decision was a good one, and I have no regrets, but it doesn't make it hard to let go of the thing that you intimately involved in for 25 years. I mean, it's a habit, you know, getting up. It becomes your identity in a weird way. Alistair King of King James. That was who I was. Nothing else made sense to me after that, you know. But it is, I mean, I think anyone who's, you know, I'm always fascinated by the other independents that sold. I mean, I studied them. I watched how they did it. I watched the impact of the corporates on those companies, whether it was Joe Public initially when they sold to FCB and TBWA and when Huntley Squires sold to TBWA and Jupiter sold to WPP. You know, I talked to those founders and I learned from them what happens to an independent when it goes into the corporate world and it's kind of taken up by a larger entity. And there's, you know, don't fool yourself. Whoever, you know, your company will change. It will never, no matter what you say to each other at that point, the smallest body will always be enveloped into the larger entity and it will never be the same again. And so, you know, anyone who's tempted to do this must know that, you know. I remember there was quite an interesting moment when we were shaking hands because the deal had been concluded, and the lawyer said to me, he said, well, you must enjoy your earnout. And I said, well, how do you know? I might be in this company for 10 years. And he laughed. He said, we do acquisitions in all sorts of industries, and the founders never ever stay in the company that's acquired them because it's just a different world. And that proved to be largely true, you know. It's at some point you've got to move on.
You've seen the industry evolve from big brand building work, the iconic work that we sometimes talk about, to a performance-led world or performance-led thinking, as it were. And now we talk a lot about AI, I guess, as one of the things. Where do you think we are right now? And what are we missing about this moment, or almost overestimating?
It's, you know, what's really fascinating, you know, when I think back, you know, I started advertising in 1989. So I wrote my first ads on a typewriter. So it was pre-computers. And I lived through that. I then witnessed, as I was starting King James, I witnessed the birth of the internet and how that was impacting communication. And so I was in a way living the change. Every sort of dimension of advertising was changing constantly, and right up to the point where when we agreed to sell King James, there was no AI. It was not being talked about as a factor that would impact the ad industry. And now it's all they talk about now is the impact of advertising, of AI on the industry, not just on the jobs and people's jobs, but also on the kind of work that's being produced. You know, a lot has said, you know, the AI is impacting it in a very negative way. And so I have a bit of perspective, I guess, because I'm not that guy that will romance the past or the golden era of advertising. But I did live through the things that broke the industry largely, or at least broke the way it appeared to be. And I do, let's be honest, prior to AI technology, if you look at the kind of advertising that was being made and that was being brought out, advertising has always been largely rubbish. 90% of what gets produced is wallpaper. It's mediocre. And that's why I think that in a weird way, artificial intelligence existed before the technology existed. There was talking to each other and still managing to produce predictable work. You know, they somehow talk themselves into sameness. And so the question now with technology and AI tech is that you can do it faster and you can do it cheaper. You can do sameness faster and cheaper because AI is literally looking for solutions in very predictable ways, which is what humans often did anyway. So, there's a wonderful writer, Stephen Sidley Boyke, who I admire deeply, and he's got he does some wonderful writings, and he recently wrote an article on AI, and he reflected on the fact that AI, essentially what it does is it goes and it can only replay and optimize known logic, is the way that he wrote it. And I think that if you treat AI like that, like give me a solution, it's going to go and find the solutions just like and give it back to you. And so it will be predictable. And the same goes for human beings. If we just default to the same levels of predictable, that's what ads should look like, this is what ads sound like, this is what a car ad should look like, you're going to come up with very very pedestrian ideas anyway. So I think that nothing's changing really, except that the people that adopt AI now, if you're doing it to optimize and cheaper and faster, you're going to get very nothing's going to change. Advertising will just continue to be bad. But if you get skilled people who like you did, skilled thinkers who looked for solutions that were a surprise, that were designed to bring brands to grab your attention, make you notice them, and you use AI for that purpose, then it will absolutely lift the caliber of the work. You know, it's a tool. How you use it, where you get your solutions from, how you crush together disparate ideas and create something new is how the brain always worked at its best. And doing that with technology, with AI, will hopefully produce the same. I guess it comes down to the priorities of the business. You know, I mean, I think it seems to me like a lot of the ad agencies are turning to AI just to make it faster and cheaper. And not necessarily to make it better or make your product better. And I think that the priorities of the business will decide how good an agency you're going to be in the future with AI embedded into your organization.
You said something about, I guess, you know, advertising having been broken before the tools or before the technologies or before the technology, rather. And the technology right now is a big sort of massive talking point. What I'm curious to know, though, or get a sense of from you is, do we know, are we fully awake or fully aware right now of what we are doing to advertising? Are we, to use the word again, are we breaking it even more? Are we improving it? Does this improve it or break it? Because from what I'm getting, the work that stands out will truly stand out because everything else is so much wallpaper. And there's so much more of that wallpaper that you actually appreciate the good work. Are we breaking advertising, marketing, the creative industries even more now, or are we improving them? Like, what do you think comes out of this era, if I could call it that, that we are in?
Yeah, I mean, that's always been the game. You know, a client and an agency meeting and talking and saying we want to do something exceptional, yeah, or not. It's always been the game. And you know, there was a point in King James, I think, you know, it happened as the digital era started to become more and more prominent and clients were shifting budget into more digital channels. We found that the kind of work that we wanted to do, which was thoughtful and considered, you know, people sitting, thinking hard about coming up with ideas that really were unique for the places, yeah, that they appeared. It took time. It took, yes, time, cost money, and clients were not always keen to wait that time or pay that money. They wanted, yeah, work much faster and much cheaper, and there was people flogging them digital platforms to say, you know, you just got to do this. And so what was happening was, even in the agency, we were dividing channels into thoughtful and considered and fast and furious, because the clients were asking for the fast and furious. They weren't necessarily differentiating fast and furious from what is, yeah, careful and considered. They couldn't tell the difference. And so, you know, we often used to joke, you know, there was a, I guess, a form of creative blindness and play with certain clients where, what you'll know this from the industry world is like, client will ask for three ideas. You'll go in with three ideas. The client will say, which is your favorite idea? And you'll say, yeah, this one. And they'll go, fantastic. Yeah. Thanks for letting us know. We'll get back to you. And then they'll all, 9 times out of 10, pick the worst one, the weakest one, because often the weakest one was the more of the predictable solutions. And we were going like, what's going on here? How is it that we can see, yeah, what would change this brand well, but the client can't? And we ended up kind of understanding or thinking that, you know, some clients get it. Some clients, yeah, just don't. They can't tell the difference between a great idea and a weak one. And I mean, we were very fortunate to have exceptional clients, and a good mix of weak ones too. But the good ones were where we really, they always picked the idea that we liked, because they, yeah, valued exceptional, unique ideas. They were prepared to work, to take the time, to perhaps even spend the money, because they understood that what it would buy you eventually would be way more valuable than something that was mundane. So, you know, I think as an agency, we held on to those clients who appreciated good work very closely. We looked after them very well. We, you know, because they were so critical for us to get the kind of work we wanted. And we believed that the kind of work that we were doing on those brands did added incredible value to the organizations that they were in. So I think that, you know, the industry has, over the 37 years that I was in the ad industry, it shifted constantly, it evolved constantly. And I think it's easier today in the digital era with AI and the demands and the priorities of global. And I just look at the global multinationals and they're all smashing companies into each other and they're all optimizing and they're serving the shareholders somewhere in the world, shareholders somewhere in some market. They're not necessarily serving the clients and they're not serving the people in the building that do the work. I think they're answering another brief altogether, and that's their choice, of course. Mm. But I do think it'll shift back.
If you're enjoying The Lead Creative, please share this episode with your network and hit follow or subscribe. Enjoy the show. I guess I want to ask how far back, how much back, but that would be, again, another prediction. What should clients be paying attention to? What should brands be paying attention to now? Because there's a lot of noise, as there always is, with any change that happens. I mean, I don't want to necessarily talk about it as though it's just AI. With any change that happens, there's a lot of noise about how it's going to change things, about how it's going to revolutionize things. What should clients be paying attention to now? And what is also just noise that is, I suppose, masquerading as strategy or as something that will be massive?
Yeah, I mean, I think the people that talk about the revolutionizing of it are probably have vested interest in selling you that story, you know, and they're talking up the technology because they're trying to sell it to you, or they're trying to sell what they do to you as superior to what was done before it. But I always James and I always used to say, well, let's stop talking about what we're going to do. Let's just do it. Put it out in the market, and people will look at it and go, that's amazing or not. You know, the proof is in the pudding always in our view. So there's a lot of hype. People are talking up all sorts of things. Everyone's got an idea on what the future agency should look like. And we really wanted to concentrate on being a great agency today. And that's how we measured ourselves. We, on any given month, we would look up and look at what our rivals were doing and say, actually, we're doing well. We're better than them, or we're not quite up to scratch. And we would adjust ourselves incrementally and try to just be a better agency. I think that if you're chasing the press release and you're chasing the hype and I think you're chasing the wrong thing. The world still requires extraordinary ideas to move people, to make them want brands. That's not going to change. And as long as you keep coming, you use that as your touchstone, and you're honest about how good you are in achieving that, then you will always be needed by a client. I really believe that. I think there will always be clients that look at what you do and say, that's a great agency. I love what they did on that. I love what they did. And come to you, and you don't have to keep pitching. They'll come to you. They'll say, I like what you did on that. Can you do it on my brand? And so there is a simplicity at work, that in any business, whether you're making hamburgers or, you know, whatever you do, it's that back to basics that I think will define the industry going forward. I think if you're trying to scale, which is the new term, you know, trying to be as big as you can, you're kind of forced to play these games, forced to adopt the technology, because that's your sales pitch. But striving for excellence, like real excellence, like creative brilliance and uniqueness, is how you do it is irrelevant. It happens or it doesn't happen. You know, what tools you use, whether you use technology or not, it speaks for itself. And that's the world that I love. Sorry, that's my voice. Welcome to suburban life.
Joys of
and that's the world I loved, you know, that constant pursuit of something wonderful. And I personally loved the interaction of people in that process. It's such a joyous occasion. Collaboration with people is such a wonderful thing. I guess collaboration with technology could be wonderful too, I guess, if it achieves a goal. But that's why I was in business. I wasn't I wasn't looking to scale the business. I wasn't looking to maximize the profits in order to sell it. It was just, we were having the best time. Did I answer your question?
Yeah, you did. You did with a lot of great detail. No, thanks for that. I think just going back to just sticking with, I suppose, brands and advertising and the state of things as we experience them, it feels as though even though we have more tools, more channels, more ways to reach people, brands still find it very hard to find resonance with people. Why do you think that is? Why is it that when there are so many touch points, so many ways to engage, brands still find it hard? What's getting lost, or what are we losing or missing?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. When I think back to the times when I thought the industry was changing and not necessarily for the better, there was, in the early days of advertising and when I was admiring the work around the world, I remember reading this line that said, never put your target market into the ad. And yeah, it was, and I thought, well, that's interesting. I wonder why. And then in time, I understood that what the way brands were built in the olden days was that you had a product and you had to make people, A, notice it, see it and want it. And so you resorted to wonderful tricks to get people to go, I like that brand. You know, it's just a biscuit. I love the biscuit. What an interesting biscuit. What a crazy thing you did with that biscuit, you know. And so brands were invented. They were created. They were imagined. Yes. And they, you know, its identity was literally birthed by people going, well, let's make the biscuit do this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
The research companies who were already doing a very good job at torpedoing good work by bringing in pre-testing and post-testing and essentially letting clients know why this ad wasn't working or not, and started swimming upstream. And so they've entered the insight game. We're gonna give you insights. Not only are we going to tell you if your ad's working, we're now going to tell you what your ad should be about to make it work. And yes. And those insights, they would go and look at target markets. They would gather stuff about the target market, and then that would be presented to you as here's your creative idea, your brand. Yeah. As long as you're speaking to the market with these things, you will be relevant to them. You know, they love football, they love music, they love whatever it is. These are the things that the market likes. Just make that the subject matter of your ad. So brands started, I guess, mimicking markets, not. Instead of creating their own identities and imagining their own, the way they existed creatively, you were essentially just trying to, you became an echo chamber of the target market you were speaking to. Yeah. And all brands had the same insights, you know, whether you're a beer brand or a bank or a cell phone, a cellular services company, you were all using the same insights, which is why there was a period in South Africa where it all looked the same because the insights were all the same. And so brands, they were no longer imagined. They were just sort of echo chambers of the society around them. And that's actually, it got more complex, because then what happened is a couple of brands started realizing that actually it's quite hard to create magic with a biscuit. We now need to give the biscuit something to stand for, some kind of purpose, some kind of social reason for being, for existing. You know, what emotional need is this biscuit going to serve? You know, and I say biscuit, but pick a brand. It doesn't matter.
Yeah,
what
brand,
emotion?
Product. I'm
yeah.
With you. Yeah.
Yeah. And so there was this. Work started to become less escapist. And I loved work when it was larger than life, because it was so wacky. You could do anything. You know, you didn't take anything seriously because you were in the entertainment business, knowing that entertainment is what drew people to you, to capture their attention and make them, drew them to your brand. It suddenly became worthy, weighty, heavy, And it lost its smile, and it became life. It, from going from larger than life to it just became life. And I think that that's took a little bit out of the took the fun out of the industry, and certainly took the edge off brands.
So one of the things that keeps coming up in conversations that that we have here, and also conversations that I hear in the industry, whether I go to a conference or whatever it is, which is something I think that almost in a way captures what you've just said, is that we now make ads that look like ads, if anything, right? Work that looks like advertising rather than advertising that, to your point, looks or feels escapist or something along those lines. And I'm also curious, just thinking back to your work, one of the things that I keep hearing a lot is that work that we admire, work that we love, work that we talk about a lot today, at the time when it was created, felt very risky. It felt like you were really pushing the envelope. But in hindsight, that work became the most iconic work or memorable work or work that people really think to when they think about a brand. Do you think the industry has become a lot more risk averse than it used to be? And how do we change that if that's the case?
Yeah. I mean, I took my inspiration from outside of advertising, and you know, you're absolutely right. I mean, I often used to think about what would happen if you were a musician and your band called Led Zeppelin wrote the song, and you wanted to pre-test it, and you went, okay, we're going to write the song. It's going to start out really slowly with a guitar. It's going to build and build and build. Some of the lyrics are, you know, Stairway to Heaven. We think it's going to be about that. And by the way, it's 7 minutes long. If you pre-tested that song, whether it's that song or whether it's Bohemian Rhapsody or the songs, like you've just said, the songs that... Yeah. The things that stood the test of time, they would have died in research. You know, research companies would have blocked them. They wouldn't have made sense at the time. And they went on to be iconic. And in fact, so many creative exercises are like that. I mean, I often wonder what would have happened if Forrest Gump had been researched. You know, like if you put the script down of Forrest Gump, it would just be, what are you? Nah, this doesn't sound like it's going to be right. There's a million reasons not to let Forrest Gump be made as a film. Least withstanding the fact that it's a 3.5-hour film, which wouldn't have passed the test. So I often, when I was in the process of creating an idea, you know, my checkpoints were always the same. Like, is this something I've seen before? And if the answer is yes, then we push it aside. And so you constantly sought a solution that seemed fresh, seemed original, and hope that in with you, your engagement with the client, you weren't going to make it less predictable, because there's a lot of brains at work here. And there's resistance to originality. Can we bring this? Can we include this? You know how simple ideas are made more complex through the process. And so the work that I loved about the work that King James did that stood the test of time is the work where there was a leap of faith from the client. There was it started out with a good idea. The client let it happen for whatever reason, whether it's trust or understanding or appreciation for what it is you are doing. And of course, directors can also mess it up too. So there's a lot of things that can happen. But the pieces that I remember fondly as having stood the test of time are those pieces where everything fell into place and no one messed with it, and everyone respected, understood what it took to be brilliant. And they were never predictable. It's scary for anyone to pursue an idea that feels utterly original. But the reward is ultimately what you speak about, you know?
So now, just to shift gears a little bit from advertising, there's this remarkable project you started with it that you were involved with, that you built, that, as you said, took longer than you thought it would. It was a labor of love, as it were. And we feel the love, by the way, as viewers, as people who consume the work. And this is the Phillipstown Wire Car Grand Prix documentary film, right? And as I was saying to you earlier, before we started this conversation, I think offline, that it captures something that, to my mind, brands really struggle with, right? There's something that already exists in a community, kids building wire cars, racing them, a community coming together. And there's this sort of realness about it, this authenticity. It's not something that feels manufactured or forced. In fact, if anything, it's very representative of the people that it kind of talks about, that it, whose lives it captures. In very many ways, I see myself as a kid in that documentary film, because I had a wire car. It was a thing, and it's a thing in every township, if you will, right? That we build these wire cars. When you first encountered this community, this race, what did you see that other people might have missed at the time?
You know, as an ad person, as someone who's been in the industry a long time, I mean, you learn to sort of trust your instincts, because if something hits you as really important and really interesting, you programmed, you wired to recognize that. And I think that Africa generally has remarkable stories that remain secrets. You know, I remember seeing those incredible photographs. I think they're in Congo, I think, with the people that have hyenas on leashes, and I think a South African photographer took those photographs. And I remember, you know, when you see that, you just go, this is remarkable. This is something that the world, you don't see that in New York, yes, or London or Asia. Yeah. It is a uniquely African thing. And I've learned to kind of, when I see those things, or I remember those things, or I stumble upon those things, they grab me, and I go, I must do something with that one day. I remember seeing a photograph of a street in Johannesburg where there was just a basket of false teeth, spare false teeth, where you could go and buy a spare false. And I was like, where in the world would that happen except here? So I too, believe it or not, grew up with a wire car. I'm Zimbabwean born. And what I've discovered about wire cars is that they are uniquely Southern African. So from Malawi downwards, we all grew up with wire cars in one shape or form. It seems beyond that, no one's ever heard of it, you know. And that's remarkable. You know, Europeans don't play with wire cars, Asians, Australians, and no one else has them except Southern Africans. And already that's a riveting idea. Yeah. The Wire Car Grand Prix came to my attention where a friend actually told me about it many years ago. And it's those things where it goes into your brain. You go, oh, that sounds amazing. I should see that one day. You know, Phillipstown is a very remote community. It's sort of 3 hours south of Kimberley. It's Northern Cape. It's very isolated. It's not on the N1. And so it's not exactly like a jump in your car and go and look at the situation. It's more of like, wow, that's really interesting that they have a race. But it was only when I went there and I saw it with my own eyes, and I felt what Wire Car meant to the kids, the role that it played. The cars are built by all sorts of people, by uncles and grandfathers and fathers and kids. It's this bonding thing that happens between between the people that build the cars and then the kids that have to run with them. So yeah. It has this wonderful, it's both engineering and building, and it's also athleticism. It's running fast for 3.5 kilometers, dirt roads. It's an awesome idea. It's already an awesome idea. But when you see it in a race format and it struck me as this, how does no one know about this race? And the truth is no one did. It's that kind of piece of information that comes to you and slowly dawns on you that the world should see this. That set in motion the project, which, you know, it occurred to me, you mentioned the film. The film is one part of the entire project. There were many layers to the project. The documentary just happens to be one part of it. But it occurred to me at some point that Accenture had all the skills in the world, gaming teams in London and Hungary, and it had the best CGI company in the world in Macavision in Hamburg. I believed we had the best creatives in the world in Cape Town and Johannesburg. I took it to them. David Droege, in fact, was one of the first people that messaged me. He said, I've heard about this idea you guys are working on called Phillipstown. Can you show it to me? And the look on his face said it all. You know, he just, like, his jaw was dropped, and he went, they do what? They run a race? This is incredible. And it's one of those instances where a company knows that it can bring an extraordinary amount of skilled people around the world to bear on one tiny little community in a way that could have massive impact in a good way for the community. So that was a sort of a 3-year venture of bringing that to fruition.
Yes.
The film, as you know, is on global Amazon Prime.
Yeah.
I, since having left Accenture, a song, I'm now free to pursue the foundation in my personal capacity. I sit as vice chair of the foundation. The rest of the committee all lives in Phillipstown. We've built a headquarters, a base where the race is going to be run every year. It grows every single year. We're hiring people to build cars, wire cars. It's the most extraordinary motor skills development activity. And it keeps them off the streets. It keeps them engaged in healthy activities. And so our goal is to essentially grow wire car culture, make Phillipstown the global capital of wire car and wire car building, and then maybe extend that love into other communities that can also benefit by it. But there's a game. So if you go on to, you can actually play the game. You can, you know, if you can't go to Phillipstown, you can push a wire car on a WGP mobile game. And so my next phase, us and the committee, is to essentially bring that story to more South Africans, extend the love of wire car and wire car culture, and bring all of that benefit to bear on the community of Phillipstown.
If you're enjoying The Lead Creative, please share this episode with your network and hit follow or subscribe. Enjoy the show.
And I think for me, it's the power of that creative idea and how much it has spread. Because, I mean, I watched the documentary film a few times, and then I went on to the foundation organization website, and I realized that the young people that we see, some of the young people that we see in the documentary, have gone on to become some of the builders that you now work with as part of the race. So I think for me, it's this power of the sort of creative idea, but also I suppose it brings up a question of what is it that brands miss when trying to tap into culture, which they all try to do, but they don't do it very successfully. So thinking to, you know, all the advertising work that you did and this film documentary, what are some of the things that brands, that marketers, that the industry misses about having a creative idea that brings people together, but also, I guess, benefits a brand. I mean, not necessarily for the benefit of a brand, but for the benefit of people, but also makes a brand, helps brands resonate in some ways. Like, are there any correlations that you're seeing?
Yeah, I mean, I think the brand mimicry that I spoke about a little earlier, yeah, where brands are merely trying to mirror back what they think you want to hear or see, or is part of the trap, I think, because it makes brands look like they're trying to wiggle their way into your heart just by showing you that they get you. Yeah. Where we had success as a company was with certain brands, was when an idea struck us as essentially something that would talk to someone's heart. You know, it would be, yeah, it's intellectually something beautiful. It's emotionally got the weight that someone's going to respond to. And then really build the values to tell that story properly. So the pieces of work that come to mind for me is, you know, sort of the Give That Man a Bells ad, where we took the story of the man who had to learn how to read in order to, yeah, to read his son's book. That's not a 30-second ad. You know, and if you're a client that says, I want this told in 30 seconds and I want to make sure that we've got a bar in there and we've got a drinking occasion and we've got all of the formulas that make alcohol advertising what it is, we would never have done that ad, you know. So in many ways, the brands that ignore the rules of the category are the ones that actually break through, because if everyone's obeying the rules of the category, every ad looks exactly the same. You've got a drinking, yeah, occasion, you've got a cheers occasion, you've got smiley people, aspirational people that reflect the kind of person that we think we all want to be, wearing the suits that we all want to have. These are all predictable, formulaic ingredients for advertising, and every category, yeah, has those ingredients. And of course, if you get 100 ads that look like that, you're not going to stand out. You have to then say, well, we're not going to make a 30-second ad that does that. We're going to make it a 2-minute ad that tells a story about a man that learns how to read. And it's not like it's a made-up story either. That story, yeah, is very common in South Africa. There was a whole, yes, generation that never got educated and had to go back and learn. It's a human truth. It's not, yeah, contrived out of the ether. It's a real thing that every age group that saw that ad loved that ad.
Yes.
You know, another one that comes to mind is way back, an ad for Alan Gray, which was all about a young boy and a little girl, and the boy was in love with the little girl. And you don't really understand why he's in love with her until you realize that it's because her mother's so beautiful, and he knows that if he's in time, she'll be beautiful too. It may not necessarily seem appropriate today, but 15 years ago, that ad was shot in Buenos Aires. Now, it's for an investment company. We could have done a lot of ads that show successful businessmen investing money, getting wealthier. The ingredients of investment advertising, none of them are what was in that ad. And that ad was a story. Yeah. It shot in Buenos Aires, not even in South Africa. It would have been easy for a client to say, well, you have to shoot it here. Not only is it cheaper to shoot it here, but it's relevant. If we shoot it here, then people know it's for them. Nonsense. Yes. People responded to the story, not the people in the ad. The language of it allowed them to absorb an idea which was potential, and time is essentially the ingredients of long-term investment. You know, those were the decisions that brave clients were making. And at that time, a brave agency was prepared to think like that. And that won't change. I think any brand today that thinks contrarian, you know, Bottle, Bogle, Hegarty, BBH used to have this thing, yin and yanging, and they said when everyone's yinging, you yang, It's yes. so true. It's that simple. It's like, don't do what everyone's doing. Literally do the opposite. And if they're doing it in 30 seconds, do it in 45 seconds. Do it in a minute. Or do it in 5 seconds. Just don't do what everyone else is doing. Such an interesting way of approaching the industry because, as you said earlier, you know, you're trying not to make an ad that blends in. You're trying to make a piece of communication that is designed to stand out. And I think that's same for film, music, art, literature, you know, AI, in any of those categories that you pick, AI is going to scour the universe for stories, whether it's a film script, it's going to pull them in, it's going to aggregate them and feed out one that sits in that comfort zone of what it's just sourced, whether it's a song or a piece of art. It's the little thing that you add to it that's going to break the predictability chain of the program is that's going to make it exceptional and make it different. And that's going to always be the game of creativity, no matter what category you're in.
I think with this, I want to just step a little bit back to what we're talking about Phillipstown, the Phillipstown Wildcard Grand Prix, because in very many ways, it doesn't do this job of mimicking. It does, for me, the job of being an insider, feeling like an insider. How do you manage that? How do you master that, this thing of being, you know, in inverted commas, an outsider looking into a culture, and you become so embedded in it that you reflect it positively, not just to itself, but to the world, that you know you don't do the negative thing that sometimes people tend to do, where if a community is under-resourced, the feeling of a community being under-resourced is highlighted way much more than the potential and the beauty and the everything else that the documentary film kind of brings up. How do you do that? What is the recipe for that? Is there some secret sauce? Like, how do you do that? Because it's often gotten so wrong than right. There are more cases of people getting it wrong than cases of people getting it right, and right in such a way that people are truly celebrated and celebrate themselves in a piece of
work.
Yeah,
I mean, there's a lot going on in that film, you know, and, you know, credit has to be given and to the filmmakers, Paul Ward at Giant Films. You know, they had an approach to filmmaking, which is exactly that. It's let's go in, let's capture the people that are there. Let's get to know them as individuals. Let's it's not scripted. Let's hear their relationship with Wirecars. And that film could quite easily have just been the story, the build up to the race and then the race and ending on the race. And that is very well told filmmaking. It's us letting Paul, deep dive into the emotion and get to know each kid on a very deeply personal level, so that they there's an intimacy about that part of the film where you just, you know, you get to know their mothers and their relationship to the church, and then you kind of voyeuristically watching, interestingly enough, observing how challenging life is for them in this community, and yet how proud they are, you know. They live not in the greatest conditions, but they are kind and gentle to each other and loving to each other. And there's you know, anyone who watches that can't help but go, oh, you know, I'm such a brat myself sometimes, you know, because there's so much humanity in this community. And then, of course, there's the twist in the film where we take the results of the race, create CGI versions of the cars, then create CGI versions of the kids and put them into the cars, and the kids get to see themselves in the race that they've run. And that the look on their faces, I mean, I was there that night when we revealed that to them. They didn't know that was going to happen. We suddenly, they projected little them was suddenly on a big screen inside a race car with a Formula One commentator commentating the race that they had run. It was such an incredible moment to witness that, and then to package that all together into a film that plays out. It's got all the ingredients of humanity beautifully captured and beautifully expressed, and then it's got this wonderful element of imagination. And and I suppose that is the yang part of the film where no one expected that. You know, I mean, ironically, one of the Kay Faree, who's the founder of the race and chairperson of the foundation, she said, this film is a little bit like Bohemian Rhapsody, isn't it? So I said, in what way? She said, it's got three parts that don't necessarily shouldn't make sense, but they just do. And it took a non-filmmaker the ability to see that as a whole film, it's surprising in many, many ways. It's capturing the community and the way that the kids are with each other is part of what draws you into it, because you want to cry at the end when you see them being heroic. You know, coming back to your original question, what blows me away is that the country doesn't necessarily know about this race. It's still a best kept secret. We all know why cars, but no one other than this tiny community bothered to hold a why car race. Think about that. The real creative leap here happened in the town itself, because they're doing something that no one else has done. And it's our job to capture that, to convey to the world. And then to the point you made earlier, is that the ambitions of the foundation are to serve the community, to make sure that not just the kids in the film, but the kids that follow. I mean, that race was two years ago. So there's a whole new generation of kids coming in who will run in this year's this year's race. And in the next year's race.
The younger ones also racing 2 years ago.
Yeah, the under eights. Yeah.
Beautiful.
And so this is not a campaign of projects. We're not going to have a version two of this film or this game. We're going to have version two and a version three and a version four of the foundation. And and we will grow it. We'll grow and spread Y Car culture wherever we can, and we're appealing to brands, we're going to appeal to government to help us do that, because you know there's around the world, wherever a community celebrates its activity, you know, whether it's chasing cheese down in Gloucester or the tomato festival in Spain, or whether it's
the pumpkin festival.
Wherever a community in the world.
South Africa,
sorry?
I'm saying the pumpkin bamboon festival somewhere here in South Africa.
Yeah, exactly.
Well.
Yeah, I mean, there are many great examples with the running of the bulls or whatever. Like, wherever a community celebrates its own activities and grows it. And it becomes, for me, it's a cultural thing worth nurturing and worth expanding upon and using it for greater good, rather than just a once a year festival. It needs to have a much more ongoing impact on because it's in our hearts already. You know, we just needed to be reminded that we all grew up with Y cars. We always need to be reminded of the joy it was to wait for someone to build it and then to steer it around the streets, whatever those streets are. We've forgotten those things, you know.
That's true. That's true. Alistair, we ask our guests to pass the mic to our next guest by asking them a question with regards to their creative process, creativity, marketing, and everything that has to do with the industry. One of the previous guests that we had was AB Mohatsane, the CMO of Investec. And the question he left for you was, what is the biggest mistake that you've made? And what do you take out of that mistake to teach others who come after you or come behind you?
Did he know you were going to ask me this question?
He didn't.
Good, because that would worry me. The biggest mistake. I wish I had a profound answer. I really wish I had a profound answer. Because I can't think of any regrets I have. Or, you know, there's been lots of little, I guess, stumbles along the way. But I suppose being impatient was both a virtue and a pain, because I think when you're young, you just want to impact yourself on the world, and I set for myself some very quick targets, you know, that in hindsight I think were unnecessary. I mean, I think that I might have compromised my life a little bit by pursuing goals in time spans that were unrealistic, and in some respects it paid off, because I came out like a racehorse. but I do think that in hindsight it's trying to get somewhere as fast as possible leads you to make bad choices. I think you can compromise yourself if you're trying to win at all cost as quickly as possible, trying to, you know, whether it's getting awards as early as possible, you compromise how you get those awards perhaps. I'd give the same advice to agencies, by the way. I think that agencies compromise themselves all the time by saying that, we need to win awards. Well, what are we going to win awards on? Well, anything. Yeah. What's an easy category right now? Where's is it a radio ad in a this category on a whatever, a bookshop or whatever it is? What's the easy way to win a prize? Will compromise you as a company in time. And I think it will compromise people if they are pursuing fame, fortune and titles too early, you know. I think one of the awkward things about being a creative person in particular, if I have to answer it as a creative, is that the happiest days of my life, I think, and it's hard to compare them because I've had many of them, but the early days of advertising when a brief would land on my desk and I'd lock myself away for 2 days. And there was before email, before the bombardment of meetings, there was a simplicity about just losing yourself in your own brain and coming up with ideas, not just one, but like 10, because it was a numbers game. If you had 10 ideas, 10 well-written ideas, not just the concepts, write them, finish writing them, and then decide which one's best, and that's the ad you put to the client. It was such a wonderful, the creative process was when you were lost in that process was when I was happiest. Obviously, when you do that well, the next question comes, can you be a group head? And go, what is a group head? No, you've got to be responsible for your own work and this person's work. And you go, okay, shit. I don't really think of myself as a people person. But sure, because it's the way to go. And so you go through the ranks, group head, creative director, blah, blah, chief creative officer, you get further and further away from the creative process. And which is why, in a weird way, that as I got more successful as a chief creative officer, I would start retreating into my office more often to spend 2 days thinking, because that was my happy place. So I think it's a long-winded way of saying one of my regrets, I think, is that I wouldn't say I got bullied into more responsibility, but I certainly got led away from my happy place, which was a creative place. And And I think it's getting harder. I think in this day and age, it's virtually impossible with diaries working the way they are, with expectations of compliance and training and blah blah. And it just becomes like your hours have shrunk. Your creative hours yes. have shrunk to little half hour segments at 10 to 10:30, 12:15 to 12:45, and those are regarded. And then if you want to think, you've got to do it in your own time at home, and that's where you compromise your family life. So so my advice to the industry was free up time, maybe ban meetings for the morning. We don't allow people to sit and engage with in meetings for clear up 4 hours, because the caliber of the work will grow.
It comes out, yeah.
Yeah, if you just ring fence quality time, and I'm not just talking creative people, everyone will be smarter. They will think more clearly. They will see solutions that can't appear to them in the cut and thrust of the day. Time is the gift, I think so.
Amazing. Alistair, now it's your turn to pass the mic to our next guest. What question would you like to leave them about marketing, advertising, creativity, or their creative process?
I would ask this question, because I think it's the question on everyone's mind, is with all the changes in the industry, is this even an industry you want to be in? That's, for me, is a very important question, because I know I can answer that very simply by saying, no, it's not what it's not the industry I wanted to be involved in, because it morphed into something completely different, and I'm not sure I would enjoy it if I carried on staying in it for another chapter. But I think it's worth saying to people, do you think that the next 5 years are going to be better or more yes. challenging, or like, are you likely to enjoy them more in this new era with all these amazing things at your disposal? Is it likely to be something you're going to enjoy more than the best 5 years of your life, wherever they were in terms of your career? I think the answer to that would be telling, because I think that it would give you a sense of people's moods and attitudes to whether this is likely to be a fun industry. It was always a fun industry. My word, we had the best time, the best. It was just wondrous, magical, creative, the way we connected with each other, the shared thing we were engaging in was such a beautiful thing. I do wonder if that has come to an end. I wonder if the industry is serving a different set of priorities, chasing share price, chasing efficiencies. Will the magic continue? And I hope there are lots of people that would say yes. But I'd be curious to know if they mean it.
Alistair, thank you so much for making time. I think one of the biggest things that I get out of that is that I suppose this idea that the more things change, the more they stay the same. The more people, the more work and advertising is out there, the more people want something that resonates, something that feels emotional, something that feels true and a sense and gives a sense of escapism rather than a sense of mimicry, as you put it.
Yeah, I mean, when you mailed me some thoughts on what you wanted to question, you did ask the one question around independence. And
yes,
do we think we're in a time
where there's a resurgence of independent agencies?
A resurgence of independence. And I was hoping we were gonna address that, because it's an interesting question. Just to end on,
let's address it. Let's do it. Yeah.
every big multinational that exists today in South African advertising came from an independent. Independents didn't, I mean, the global organizations didn't arrive and start an agency. Not many of them did. One or two of them have, but most of them acquired the best independents in the country at the time. So mm-hmm. Hunt Lascaris went TBWA, Radford Saltrip and Macon sold to Ogilvy. It's the pattern. It's the pattern that that it always starts with the independents. I feel like that we've come through that pattern now where it's there, you know, when I started King James with James, there were five or six or seven independents that were all very good. And they all in one shape or form ended up in a multinational or being absorbed and created a new entities. And right now it's happening again. There are, I guess, sort of half a dozen really competitive independents, including Joe Public, which might be one of the best, if not the best in the country right now, as an independent. And so we are, I would love, you know, if I had another 30 years to in my life to do this again, this would be the best time to be an independent. I think the industry is going to turn over. It's going to, the multinationals will become heavy and weighty. And I'm not saying, yes. You know, some of the best agencies in the countries are multinationals. They continue to do great work. And there are equally, there are some terrible or very average independents doing very mediocre work. It's not a rule per se that independents are great and multinationals are not. But it is a cycle that I think the independents, if you started an independent today, you would be able to relive what we did when we started. You'd be able to build something small, make it grow, enjoy that.
And this is something I have a question about, because I think there was, I mean, as you rightfully say, you know, when you were building King James, there was a lot of independents that were quite a few independents, a handful of them that were growing. That became big, and some of them became acquired. Or at least to my mind, what I kind of tend to see is this sort of cyclical nature of things where sometimes work tends to go to the multinationals and sometimes it goes to independents, and as a result, the independents grow and there's a bit of a cycle that comes back around again. And I'm using this to kind of saying this to say that in a way I'm kind of seeing that a few brands, there are quite a few in South Africa, South African brands that have moved from multinationals to independents. And I think this has been happening over the past sort of 3 or so years that I've kind of been paying attention to it. I haven't been paying attention to it for a long time, to be honest. But I've noticed that some of these brands have moved from multinational to independents, and the same brands have kind of done that in the past before, right? They kind of did this thing and now they're doing it again. Is it a cyclical thing, or is it because there is a resurgence, or is it a combination of the two, that sometimes there is a resurgence and sometimes it's cyclical? It's just a way that it happens in the industry.
I think it comes down to each and every marketer involved, is that they make the choice. You know, we were fortunate to have, you know, I think being an independent doesn't make you a shoo-in. You have to be a great agency and be independent to really be attractive to a client who's saying, I want that independent agency, and or I want that multinational. I mean, that also happens. You know, it's entirely dependent on the client. I mean, there are clients who say, I like the engagement. I want the people in the room to be the owners of the company, because when I have someone to shout at, I know I'm shouting at the owner. It's not gonna, you know, it's a very personal connection between a client and an agency when it's owner led, I think. Yes. And there are clients that absolutely want that. I want the owner in the room. I want to know that it's going to be sorted out immediately by them. And I like lifting South African businesses. I'd love to see more of that, to be honest. I think that, in, you know, it's And I think there it's gonna it's it, we were fortunate to be beneficiaries of clients who said, you are not just a great agency, but I love the fact that you're independent. So here's my business. And I don't think that'll ever change, which is why I think that in this world right now where there is fragmentation, people are confused about what the industry is really about. Clients are going to look to agencies that are clear on what they stand for, the kind of work they believe in, and they're going to connect with that vision for rather than some sales pitch and aggregated set of benefits. It's going to be, come, grow me and I'll grow you. And that's a very personal decision, you know. So it would be a good time, I think.
For sure. Absolutely. Alistair, thank you so much. Once again, it was a great conversation.
Thank you, Mangezi.
Thank you for listening to The Lead Creative. Did you get one insight that's worth sharing from this episode? Please share it with your network or your friends. Pop me some of your ideas and innovative finds on Twitter on @Mongezi. This podcast is available on Spotify, Stitcher, Apple, Google, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also find me on mongezi.com.